We are truly delighted to be joined by one of the world's most influential philosophers, Peter Singer, and also a rising YouTube star. We're going to be talking about Peter's latest book, Animal Liberation Now. Peter, would you like to start with a real life case?
Yeah, absolutely. A case that I think is interesting for illustrating the way we think about humans and animals and the differences between humans and animals is one that happened a few years ago in Florida with a baby with anencephaly. Now, anencephaly is perhaps the most severe birth defect you can have. It really effectively means no brain. But there is a brain stem. So technically, say in terms of definitions of brain death, there is some brain. And that brain stem regulates things that we do even when we're asleep, like we breathe and the heart pumps. So that still happens. But in terms of an anencephalic child actually, you know, having conscious experiences, without a cortex, it seems that that's impossible. So this child would never smile at her mother, for example, or enjoy anything particularly. So that's a really dire condition. And the standard treatment is really non-treatment. Babies born with this condition are not, there's no attempt made to keep them alive, and they die within a few days. Occasionally, there was a case in Virginia of someone who was a Christian fundamentalist who wanted the anencephalic child kept alive, and the child lived a year or two, I think, if I remember rightly, and died. So it's possible to keep them alive for a much longer period. But generally speaking, once the parents understand how dire their prospects of their child are, they agree that no treatment should be given. But in this case, so the parents understood the condition of their child, but rather than simply allow the child to die, they said, could the child be used as an organ donor? Now, an anencephalic child could be a very valuable organ donor because there are babies born with a heart defect, which will prove fatal in a relatively short period of time. And getting a heart transplant is unusual because there are very few babies who die with a heart that can be transplanted. Because normally when we transplant organs, the heart doesn't stop beating, but somebody is brain dead, for example, in a car accident. But this doesn't happen very often to very young babies. So the parents often said, can the baby be used as an organ donor? And the heart could have been used. But for that to really be an intact, useful donation, you have to surgically remove the heart while it's still beating. You can't simply not treat the child and then after the child has died and the heart has stopped beating, take the heart out. It's unlikely to be useful anymore once it's stopped in that way. I think there was a hospital that was interested in getting the organs, but they said you have to go to a court and get permission because we would be cutting the heart out of a living child. And the court refused permission. The court said the doctor would effectively be murdering the child and you can't do that. So baby Teresa died and the heart was not able to be used. Now, this is an interesting contrast with the use of animals as organ donors, because there is no law, and it is certainly not unusual for hearts to be removed from living animals, whether they're dogs or monkeys. There was a case of a baboon's heart that was attempted to be transplanted into a human. And originally in South Africa, in fact, when Dr. Christian Barnard did the world's first heart transplant, he used a chimpanzee. And nobody said that's a terrible thing to do because you're killing a chimpanzee, or maybe some animal activists said that, but not many. And certainly it was fully legal. So that's the question that I'd like to start with. Can you possibly justify the idea of killing an animal with a significantly higher degree of intelligence and capacities for enjoying life than an anencephalic human, and say that it would be wrong to do that to the anisotropic human, because you know, human life is inviolable. It's always wrong to kill an innocent human being. Human life is sacrosanct. These various phrases are used. But what does that really say about the preference we have for humans? How can that be justified? Is there any way of justifying that difference?
So part of the problem here seems to be that people don't know how to describe the case. So are you killing an individual that's not able to ever experience any cognitive function? Or are you killing a human being? Or are you killing, for example, a disabled person, which is what some of the criticism of your work has come down to? And depending on how you describe the case and how you lump that individual into a larger group and killing an instance of that group, that seems to sway people's intuitions. So what is the best way of understanding these cases? Should we think about only that individual or the group of which they're a part?
I think you should think about the individual. Now, of course, all of the descriptions that you mentioned apply. You are killing a human being. You are, if you like, killing an innocent human being. You are killing a being with no prospect of positive, enjoyable experiences in life, no prospect of becoming an autonomous or independent human being. You could say no prospect of becoming a person in John Locke's sense of a being who understands themselves as the same entity existing over time. And also, of course, killing a person with a disability, but an extremely severe disability. I think that it's much better to look at the individual facts of the case, because I'm a consequentialist. That is, I judge actions by their consequences for all those affected. And just trying to place it into categories as if you have a rule that says it's always wrong to kill an innocent human being, or it's always wrong to kill a person with a disability, I don't think those rules can be defended as universally applicable rules. I think you have to look at the details of the case to decide whether they are or are not validly applied in that case.
So I suppose the idea of looking at the individual case is to try and extrapolate some rules for further decision making. One of the things that might make a difference in this case is that the mother volunteers. So she says, look, I don't want this being that I've carried in my, you know, my body for 9 months to go to waste. And if I could save the life of another child, well, that's something that I'd like to do. And that might tip the scales in one direction. Of course, the being itself doesn't get to participate in this choice. But we could imagine something else, which is that hospitals have a policy where if the child is born and doesn't have very long prospects of living or would lead a life of general suffering, that the hospital then actively kills those kids and harvests their organs to save many lives. And you might think that that actually generates more goods. You take the choice away from the parent. Those that have a squeamishness about it don't have to apply their minds, and the hospital could then save many, many young children who would then grow up to become fully functioning persons.
Yes, you're right. I mean, those are a range of considerations. I was focused on this particular case, which, as I say, came before a court, had to be decided by a judge. If you had a general policy and you allowed the hospital to make that decision, especially if you allowed the hospital to make that decision without getting the consent of the parents, I can see a range of problems. One is that the parents might very much want to keep their child alive as long as possible. As I mentioned, that did happen with the one case. And then there's, you know, that's even if I think that their reasons for doing that were false, based on false beliefs about, you know, the existence of some moral rules, perhaps from a divine creator. Nevertheless, their views and their feelings should be given some weight. So that's one factor. The other factor might be, if you allow hospitals to make these decisions, then there's a possibility of them being abused. You know, we're only too familiar with cases in the past, at least, and perhaps still happening, in which people from racial minorities or with otherwise marginalized backgrounds get less good treatment in hospitals than those from the mainstream. There would be a danger that that would happen, that perhaps some particularly privileged person, maybe even a wealthy person who might be donating to the hospital, would be given an organ from some person who was not in a position to benefit the hospital in any way. And I don't think you would want that to happen. So there are those questions about how you would control each individual case if you have general policies. And I think that's reasonable. But in this particular case, as you mentioned, the parents wanted the child to be used as an organ donor. The whole thing originated with their request. There was no suggestion from the hospital initially. So I do think that that makes the case quite different.
So I'm curious what your view is on the animal donor case. So if you think it's permissible for the anencephalic child to be used as an organ donor, do you think it was permissible in the testing that that led up to the first heart transplant for pig hearts to be used as donor hearts? Do you think that was permissible too?
I think that's a much more difficult question. I'm regarded as somebody who thinks that all animals are equal, including human animals. And that's true to the extent that I think that where we have similar interests, we should not weigh the human interests more than the similar interests of a pig or a cow or a monkey. But what I mean by that is, if you have a situation where, let's say, there is physical pain that will be inflicted, it won't be fatal. The sentient being, whether human or non-human, will continue to live, but there will be an hour of reasonably severe physical pain. I think it's just as bad if you inflict that on the pig, dog, rat, monkey, as if you inflict it on a human who would experience a similar kind of pain. But I don't claim that the interests that normal humans have in continuing to live are the same as the interest that non-human animals have in continuing to live. They may be. I think you would need to look at it in particular cases, and there may be some species of which might have this awareness of their future and desires for the future, which normal humans do. But I think it's there certainly would be many non-human animals who don't have that capacity, and there would be others who would maybe have it to a much lesser extent. So, you know, we live lives where we plan years ahead. We plan what we're going to do. So I'm about to retire from Princeton University. I've been thinking about that for 2 or 3 years. I've been thinking what I might do when I retire from Princeton University. And so I've been planning years ahead, and I still am. Whereas I don't think that non-human animals do that, or there doesn't seem to be good evidence that they do that. They may plan ahead for a shorter time period. But so I think you could say that the loss to the humans is different in various ways. That might depend on what view you hold of well-being or welfare and what it consists in. And also, I think it's relevant to say that the awareness in the human population that somebody was being killed against their will would cause alarm and fear and insecurity in a way that it won't in the case of a non-human animal being killed. So I think that there are some differences, although I think we exaggerate those differences. And the other important point, and going back to the case of baby Teresa, is that the differences depend, as I say, on us having the cognitive capacities of normal humans. And if it's an anencephalic child who doesn't and never will have those capacities, then I think that changes it. And it's, in my view, therefore, much more difficult to defend giving a preference for the life of the anencephalic human over that of the human, sorry, over that of the dog, pig, monkey, than it would be if you were comparing a normal human with those non-human animals.
So the one differentiator that someone might make is as follows. They'll say, it is the case that the capacity of this being is very similar to that of an animal. Maybe the animal even has a greater capacity for suffering, for experience. But once we open up the door to killing members of the species of humans, we have engaged in some kind of symbolic wrong. We are not just making a claim about this child, but about humans generally, and that's dangerous. What do you make of that sense of trying to put symbolic wrongs on the table when we're out of the realm of pain and pleasure?
I think that we can draw distinctions. What you've presented is essentially a slippery slope argument, that we have to hold the line at killing innocent humans, otherwise all sorts of atrocities will follow. And that argument was put forward when I first started looking at life and death issues in life and death decisions in medicine, and got interested in voluntary euthanasia, or as it's now more often medically assisted dying or medical aid in dying. That was, you know, there were basically two arguments. There was a kind of a absolutist deontological ethic, often argued by people of a religious background, that said, no, it's just always wrong to end an innocent human life. You must never intentionally do that. But often it was backed up with, or sometimes, you know, alone, the argument was the kind of argument that you have, that once you allow voluntary euthanasia or assisted dying, you're going to get this slippery slope. And I think that, you know, in the 1970s, that was a relatively plausible argument in that area, because there was really no experience in modern times of the open practice and legal practice of voluntary euthanasia. But we've now had about 40 years of experience of that, starting in the Netherlands, where it is a voluntary euthanasia. That is, doctors have been able to give lethal injections to their patients who are terminally or incurably ill at the request of the patient. And that's now spread to a large number of other countries, mostly in the form of medically assisted dying, where the doctor can't give a lethal injection but can prescribe a drug which the patient can then take, and they will fall asleep and die in their sleep. And that's now pretty widely practiced. I'm speaking to you from Australia. Every state in Australia has now legalized medically assisted dying. Canada has medically assisted dying everywhere. Quite a few states, I think it's a dozen or so now in the United States, have it. And several European countries, Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and even formerly Catholic countries, perhaps you might call them, like Spain and Portugal, have it. So, and there hasn't been any evidence of that slippery slope that I can see, you know, certainly not in the way it was suggested, that this will lead to really dire Nazi-like atrocities. So the question is, you know, is that because the consent of the person was required? And in the case that I've been talking about, the consent of the infant is impossible, obviously, and what was required was the consent of the parents. So I would say, no, I think that where the consent of the parents is required, we have a good safeguard. Really, I think, as strong as the safeguard of the consent of the patient, when we're talking about infants who are completely incapable of giving consent. Because, you know, I think we can assume that parents care for the best interests of their patients. Oh, sorry, the parents care for the best interests of their child. If it were to be a policy in some way without the consent of parents being required, then you might start to worry, as I was saying earlier, you might start to worry about the misuse of the opportunity to obtain organs for more privileged patients as compared with less privileged ones?
There might be a way of putting Mark's concern that doesn't boil down to a slippery slope. So there might be just a way of saying, well, if you use the principle, whatever principle it is, a consequentialist principle that supports the permissibility of euthanizing an encephalic baby, you could also use that principle to euthanize other sorts of disabled children, and you might get the wrong result according to many people. So, for example, could you euthanize a Down syndrome child using the same principles?
Well, there have been cases where parents have not wanted their Down syndrome child to live. There was a famous case during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, called the case of Baby Doe, which was a Down syndrome child who was born with a blockage of the esophagus, of the passage that leads from the mouth to the stomach. And that kind of blockage does happen. It was clearly associated with Down syndrome, or it's more common in children born with Down syndrome than in others. Although, you know, certainly most Down syndrome children don't have that. And it's not that difficult to remove the blockage and repair the esophagus. It's not always, or certainly wasn't then, always a successful operation. But it's certainly a reasonably straightforward procedure. But the parents refused consent for the operation. And the mother had had experience teaching children with Down, so she knew what the future of her child was likely to be. Although, of course, you know, it's children with Downs vary significantly, and you couldn't really know. But she said, on being told that the child had Downs, that she didn't want it, and her husband supported her in that. So they refused permission. The hospital took them to the State Supreme Court of Indiana. That court sided with the parents and said they had the right to refuse consent to the operation. By that time, there was a huge outcry, particularly among Reagan's conservative supporters, and an appeal was launched to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the baby died before the appeal could be heard. So Reagan then issued a ruling, which was an attempt to stop what they referred to as discrimination against children with disabilities. I don't think that would be done, or I think hospitals would say, you know, they would have to operate on that child in the US today. But, you know, how should we think about that? Many people will say, and they will point, particularly say parents of a Down syndrome child, they will point to the child and say, they say, look, our child is having a good life, and Down syndrome children certainly can have an enjoyable life. And they will also say our child is very loving, and, you know, the family loves the child and the child enriches the family. And that certainly may be true. I don't challenge that will often be the case. But I suppose the question is, who should make this decision? Should the state make the decision, or should the parents make the decision? And I'm inclined to think that the parents should have the right to make that decision. I do think that they need to be well advised. As I said, it seemed like these parents did know quite a lot about Down syndrome. But if they may have prejudice against it. I think it would be good for them to see children with Down syndrome, to talk to parents of people with Down syndrome before making that decision. But if after all that they say, look, you know, this is not the child that we want to have. We want to have a child who can be educated to a level that is very unlikely for a Down syndrome child, for example, a child who we can have in later years the kinds of conversation with, or even a child who will support us in our old age. It's something that people want. And another factor might be a child who will give us grandchildren, because Down syndrome people are normally not fertile. I think that's a decision that, you know, can inform parents should be able to make. It's not as if in many of these cases, it's not as if somehow a happy child is lost to the world. The parents are quite likely to conceive another child, and that child is unlikely to have Down syndrome, so there will be a child who will come into existence. So if you're going to say, well, it's a pity this child couldn't live, then you have to say, but if the child did live, probably the parents would not have had this replacement child, if you want to call it, because they would have needed to care for the child who lived, or, you know, in any case, they had a fixed idea of how many children they wanted to have. So I think it's reasonable to leave that decision to parents.
So we've spoken quite a lot about difficult choices to be made with human beings and the possible benefits you could get, like sacrificing one to save the life of another. What we find with the practice of eating meat is that on the one hand, you have the human pleasure of eating meat. And on the other hand, you have enormous amounts of animal suffering. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what is involved in that factory farming process and how things have changed since you first wrote Animal Liberation and what they look like now.
So the latter part of your question, how things have changed, varies from country to country. But there's no country that's legislated to prevent factory farming altogether. There's no country that requires that all animals raised for food have to be have access to outdoors, that they can't be confined in a shed, for example, or in most cases, and for some animals, in a space much smaller than a shed, like in stalls for pigs, or group housing, but maybe still very confined. And in the case of chickens, incredibly crowded. So I think that the progress has been limited. There has been some progress with some forms of confinement being banned in particularly the European Union, which I think is well ahead of every other country that I know about. And I'm talking about all of the European Union, 27 nations, I think it is at the moment. They require, for example, that all animals must be kept in conditions that they can turn around, that they can move, or that they can stretch their limbs. And in the case of egg-laying hens, that they can fully stretch their wings. Now, you know, the fact that that, as I say, is in the European Union and is an advance over the conditions that prevail generally in the United States, where there are some states that are exceptions, but particularly the states that produce large numbers of factory-farmed animals do not have anything comparable to the European Union. That shows that you know what the conditions are like, that you can, and in the United States, the majority of egg-laying hens are still in those standard wire cages that are too small for them to stretch their wings. And the cages are themselves very crowded. They will hold four or five hens in one such cage. If we're talking about pigs, the breeding sows, the mother pigs, can be kept in stalls so narrow that they can't turn around for their entire pregnancy. And as they're breeding pigs, they're pregnant most of their lives. They're only taken out of these stalls to give birth when they're put in another very confining stall called a farrowing stall, and then they're either artificially impregnated or put with a boar, and, as you know, once they're pregnant again, they go back into the stall. And the pigs who are actually raised to be sold to market are also extremely crowded, despite pigs being intelligent, playful animals who evolved in forests and normally would spend their day rooting around looking for food. And sows who are about to give birth would actually create a kind of a nest that would be comfortable for their pigs. They would brush together leaves and twigs and so on to find a comfortable place to bed and give birth in the forest. This is standard for factory farmed animals. And it's also that there are problems with the fact that they have been bred to grow very fast, because the economics are such that the sooner you can get your chicken or pig to market weight, the more profitable it will be. So there's been a lot of effort to produce, let's just take the chickens as an example, to produce a chicken that gets to the standard weight of a chicken in about half the time now that they used to maybe 20 or 30 years ago. So the standard chicken that is you see on sale in a supermarket was killed at about 6 weeks of age. It's basically a baby, but it's very large as a baby. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, you have this very young bird, very heavy, eating a lot, and the bird's legs are still immature. So experts who've looked at this say that the birds are in pain just from standing up. One vet, John Webster, has described it as forcing somebody with arthritis in their legs to stand all day. And you might say, well, why are they standing? Why don't they just sit down? There's a reason why they're standing. They're standing on what's called litter, that is like wood shavings, sawdust, maybe sometimes straw, which is filled with their droppings and with the droppings of in a large number of flocks before them. You know, maybe the shed gets cleaned out once a year, maybe not even that. Now, bird droppings are very high in ammonia, and ammonia is an alkaline substance. And when you sit on bird droppings and you have moisture on your skin, you actually get a caustic burn. It's like a strong caustic substance. So if the birds actually sit down, their skin on their thighs and or their chest gets burned. So that's painful for them as well. And a certain percentage of these birds will actually, their legs will collapse under them. And because, you know, you've got to imagine a large shed with 20,000 birds filling that shed. Nobody takes any individual notice of the birds. So if a bird's legs have collapsed under her and she doesn't happen to be in reach of food or water, the food or water comes through pipes that are at, you know, spaced at intervals across the shed, she is just going to die of thirst, probably thirst before dying of hunger. Because, as I say, nobody's going to pay any attention to her. She's not worth very much. Nobody would even think of calling her a vet. That would be absurd in economic terms. And maybe somebody will walk through the shed now and again and pick up the corpses. But that's probably about it. There's another thing that should be said about these very fast-growing animals, which applies to the chickens and to the pigs. So they're bred to have enormous appetites. What about the bird? What about their parents? What about the breeder chickens and the breeding, as I said, the sows and the bull? They obviously have to have the same genes. So they also have to have enormous appetites. But if you fed them as much as they would like to eat to satisfy those appetites they're bred to, they're quite unlikely to survive long enough to be sexually mature. Because, as I said, the chickens and the pigs are not sexually mature when they're killed. They're still very young. But they would get so obese that they might just die of a heart attack. And if they didn't, they might not be able to have sex at all because, you know, they're just the males would be just too fat to get to the right point. So how do you deal with that problem? Basically, you starve these animals. Or you semi-starve them. So this, you know, you can read this in the producers' journals. You feed them only once every second day, perhaps. And then, you know, they're so desperate for food because they're bred to have these huge appetites, they may drink too much water. And so, you know, if they're drinking too much water, then you reduce the water flow to them as well. So you've bred birds or pigs to have huge appetites, and then you leave them to be hungry pretty much the whole time. But that's just the economics of the system. You know, it's because we regard them as commodities, because we have a competitive market, because if you don't produce them as cheap as your competitor, you'll be out of business, and because there's no regulation to stop this. And that's true generally even in the European Union, so it's even more true in other jurisdictions. There's some talk in the European Union of what they call a better chicken program, which would have slower growing birds, but it certainly hasn't, it's not legislated for, and it's not at all the standard as yet. But that acknowledges the problems that we have with factory farming.
So I have two objections in mind. Before I give the objections, I just want to say that it's a very good case for just how horrific the meat industry is, factory farming is. But some people would argue the following. So they would say, yes, it's true that animals suffer, and yes, that is a bad thing, but the type of suffering that animals have is different from the type of suffering that humans have. So you mentioned earlier that humans have long-term projects and goals. So many humans think about what they'll do 5 years from now. They may want to have children, or if they have children already, that they want their children to go to college and get married. They want to pursue some dream. They want to get a PhD. They want to write a book. They want to, whatever it is. Animals don't have those dreams. And also, animals seem to lack a certain form of self-awareness. They may have some form of self-awareness, but maybe they lack the form of self-awareness that's very much involved in deep suffering. The Buddha talked a lot about this. So the Buddha said, there is physical pain, but then there is the suffering on top of that physical pain, which involves thinking about it and mulling it over and thinking how awful it is and how this is going to impact my life and my future goals, which maybe animals are not capable of, or at least some of those steps they're not capable of. And the Buddha thought that made the suffering much worse for humans. And a lot of Buddhism is about trying to alleviate not the physical suffering, but that suffering on top, which animals might not be capable of. So even if it is the case that animals are suffering very deeply, it still may not be the case that they're suffering as deeply as humans are in the same circumstances. And so even if we think something bad is happening, we might not think the wrong that is happening is as wrong. And then the second objection is, even if it is the case that it is as wrong, right? So even if we put that objection aside, even if animal suffering is as bad as human suffering, it's not very clear that the human that eats an animal, buys some meat off a supermarket shelf, whether that person eating that meat is causally responsible for the suffering that that animal went through.
Okay, good. So on the first point, it no doubt is true that normal humans with the cognitive abilities intact are capable of some forms of suffering that non-human animals are not. And maybe that makes the suffering deeper in some way. Sometimes, of course, it may actually alleviate the suffering. You may know that this is going to be over at some point, and you may be able to tolerate it better because of that. So it's not easy to say whether the cognitive capacities always make the suffering worse, while saying that, you know, yes, there's the potential for the suffering to be different, certainly, and quite possibly worse in some circumstances. But I think even if you acknowledge that, you should still accept that, you know, given the descriptions that I've given, and I could have gone on for the rest of the time that we have. There's a lot more to be said. And if people want to look at it, they can pick up Animal Liberation Now, my 2023 fully updated edition of Animal Liberation, and they'll find a lot more than I've had time to say. So, you know, even if you think that human suffering is different, what we're talking about is not making animals suffer in order to prevent deeper human suffering. We're talking about making animals suffering in order to give humans the food that they choose, or that many of them choose, which they believe, and we could accept the belief for the moment if you like, which they believe gives them more pleasure or is tastier or something like that than a vegetarian or vegan diet. So I think, you know, when that's what you're weighing in the scale, I don't think the argument can go through in terms of accepting products from factory farms. It might go through, if you talk about animals who really have good lives or outdoors in conditions completely natural for their species, and then are killed painlessly, preferably, you know, on the farm rather than being trucked to slaughter. You know, I know there are people who do that, who only choose those products, conscientious omnivores, and you know, the argument that I've just given based on factory farming doesn't apply to that. You would need a different kind of argument. Before I get on to the second argument, I'd just say, since you mentioned Buddha and Buddhism, I think, you know, yes, maybe Buddha talked about those differences, but also we should give Buddhism credit for the idea that compassion should be extended to all sentient beings. Buddhism has been very explicit on that for more than 2,000 years, whereas Christianity has denied that for most of its, if you look at the mainstream of Christian thinking anyway, Augustine, Aquinas, people like that, they didn't deny that the suffering of animals matters. So I think we should give Buddhism credit for that. And I'll put in another quick plug for my actually most recent book, which is called The Buddhist and the Ethicist, a dialogue I had with a Taiwanese female monastic called Shi Chao Wei, in which we explore, among other things, the convergences between my secular utilitarian view of how we should treat animals and her Buddhist view. But let me get back to your second question, which was the causal question. Right? Now, it's true that if I go into a supermarket and pick up a chicken and purchase it, I have not caused the suffering of that chicken. That chicken was already dead, and my decision to go into the supermarket and buy it had nothing to do with the fact that it suffered. It was already dead, as I say. But I think to say that you have no causal connection with the suffering of other chickens, future chickens, if you like, who the supermarket will order and who will be, because of the supermarket's continuing orders, therefore the chicken producers will produce them to meet those orders. I think there has to be a connection there. I mean, you know, people say, well, the supermarket orders 1,000 chickens a week, let's say, or, you know, maybe 1,000 chickens a day, depending on how big it is. And how is it going to notice? Well, it's not going to notice one purchase, but it must have some threshold. And if chicken sales drop below a certain point, it must then reduce its chicken purchases. It doesn't make sense that it could continue to purchase the same number of chickens, even if the sales drop. So at some point, there's a threshold. Let's say it does order 1,000 a day. And let's say if sales drop by a certain number, perhaps 100, then instead of ordering 1,000 a day, it only orders 900 a day. Okay, so the chances are you won't be the person who keeps it above that threshold, but there's a 1 in 100 chance that you will be, and then you will be responsible for the purchase of 100 additional chickens, and that order being fed back to the producers, responsible for 100 additional chickens being raised in the factory farm conditions I describe. I think there has to be some connection like that. Otherwise, you know, you're sort of detaching supply and demand, which is the fundamental point of economics, is that demand creates future supply.
So one way of thinking about it is a little bit like voting. So the chances of you personally affecting the outcome of an election are close to zero. But of course, if everybody decided not to vote, that would make a gigantic difference. And obviously you can rally lots of people together to vote in support of one candidate, and that'll make a difference. And so vegetarianism as a movement might very well make a difference for shifting the scales. But the question is this, is when you're trying to make an individual choice, are you obligated to make a choice, which is not to buy meat, when it may be that at the end of time, when we look at all of your choices, you didn't move the needle at all? So every time you voted for the Green Party in America, maybe you're voting for the best possible party, the party with the most righteous beliefs, and it never led to a Green candidate becoming president. And so you might think that engaging in that behavior didn't move the needle. And if you care about actual utils in the world, that all you could claim is some kind of symbolic win. And you could say, well, I participated in a good movement, even if the movement didn't lead to, or I didn't lead to anything particularly good. The movement might have, but your choice didn't.
Well, there has to be a positive expected value of your choice. And don't start me on the American voting system, because that'll take up the rest of our time, right? Here in Australia, we have preferential voting, what Americans call ranked choice, and it produces much better results than the first-past-the-post system that Americans have. And, you know, especially if you're talking about people voting for the Greens, of course, the people voting for Ralph Nader, the Green candidate in 2000, gave the election to George W. Bush rather than to rather than to Al Gore, who would, I'm sure, have adopted vastly better policies on a whole range of issues, very notably climate change. So, I am a consequentialist. I think to vote Green in the United States, in a state which could tip the election, as the state of Florida did in 2000, is the wrong thing to do. I think it was you shouldn't do that. And the symbolic value of there being another vote for the Greens is not worth the risk of electing the wrong candidate. But to transfer that to the case of meat consumption, I think the expected value of boycotting meat is clearly higher than the expected value of continuing to purchase meat. Partly for the reason that I've mentioned, that there's a chance that it will lead to a drop in the orders of your supermarket for these products. Secondly, that it does help to build a movement. And the more people who are not eating meat, the more alternative products we have. And we've seen that pretty clearly over the last 20 years as the number of vegans in particular has grown. Suddenly, and because I go back 50 years in this movement, when I started, nobody understood what the word vegan meant. And no supermarket, I was in England at the time, which is pretty vegetarian-friendly nation, but there was no supermarket that was really carrying vegan products. You had to go to a special health food store to buy them. Whereas now, every supermarket will have some products. So I think building up the movement to a critical mass makes it easier for others to join, and makes it more easier at restaurants. Most restaurants now offer one or two vegan options because they realize that otherwise, if you have a group of eight people coming for dinner, there's a fair chance that one of them won't be eating meat and they'll go somewhere else if you don't offer anything. So I think we are building a movement. I wish it was happening faster and was more powerful, but I think it's still happening. So those are important reasons why we should continue to boycott meat.
So I take it that many people would agree with you today, maybe not in the 70s, but today many people would agree with you that the factory farming operation is horrific, that something horrendous has happened, even if they disagree that it would be as bad as if those animals were replaced by humans, they still agree that something terrible has happened. But they hold something like Marx's objection, which is that I don't really affect that too much. Now, it seems like you have a bit of a dilemma. So on the one hand, you might say, I either do have my choice to buy meat at a supermarket either is actually efficacious in causing more orders to be put in at the factory farm, or it's not. If it's not, then there's a probability that it could have been, and that probability alone is sufficient. So either we look at actual consequences or we look at probabilities. If we look at actual consequences, then you permit the possibility that Mark's case goes through at least sometimes, which is that in any given case, I purchase the meat, but that doesn't result in more orders actually being placed. My purchase doesn't meet the threshold. It doesn't drop the number of orders below the threshold so that, or raise it above the threshold so that the supermarket orders more chickens from the factory farm. So it's possible if you only care about actual consequences that my choices never matter. And it may be that, let's say I'm a very quiet meat eater, so that no one really pays attention to me. I'm a deep introvert. I only ever eat alone. No one thinks about whether I do or don't eat meat. And so my choices don't impact the general movement and don't change whether there's a snowball effect of many people stopping to eat meat or starting to eat meat or continuing to eat meat. So that's the problem with the actual consequences. The hermit who eats meat, he might be fine. If we think about probabilities, so expected utility, then yes, there is a certain probability that my eating meat will impact these larger movements. So the larger movement of the order of 100 chickens, or the larger movement of people eating meat generally, or if I don't eat meat, that my decision has a probability of contributing to the snowball effect. But what that does, when you look at that probability, you mentioned one in 100 earlier, what that does is it waters down the wrong. So it says, my eating meat is not a one-to-one equivalence with the order of extra meat. What it is it's 1/100th. And I don't know what that number is. It could be 1%, it could be 0.1%. I don't know what that probability is. But it seems like what it does is it's a divider, right? So it takes the number of negative utils, the number of negative consequentialist points, and divides it by 100 or 1,000 or whatever that percentage is. And that then says, okay, I'm doing something wrong when I eat meat, but it's not that bad. It's maybe akin to not helping an old lady across the street. It seems like when you don't help the old lady across the street, you've done something wrong in the sense that you could have done something better, but it's not that bad. And maybe the way to think about life is that there's a lot of things that we could do on a daily basis that would increase our moral quotient, our moral value in the world. We could be helping people more than we are, but we don't think that many of those actions are obligatory. We think that they're supererogatory. So you might think that eating meat is something that's optional, or refraining from eating meat is something that's optional. It would be a very good thing to do, but it's not obligatory, because the wrong involved in eating meat is only just a little wrong. It's not too bad.
Well, I don't accept that it is a little wrong, because even if, you know, as in the example I gave you, even if there's only a 1 in 100 chance that my not buying a chicken at the supermarket will change the size of the supermarket's order, it will change it by much more than one chicken. It will change it by 100 chickens. So I think that's just as wrong as if there were a certainty that it would increase the order by one chicken. You know, but maybe we have an illusion about wrongness, which doesn't take numbers fully into account. So that if somebody, you know, this is a version of the example that Bernard Williams made of Jim and the Indians. If someone says, look, we're going to kill, we're planning to kill a lot of people here. You can either shoot one with certainty and we'll let the others go, or we can toss a coin and if it comes down heads, you have to kill three of them. But if it comes down tails, you don't kill any of them. So, you know, perhaps people would say, well, I would rather toss the coin because maybe I won't be killing anyone. And yet, obviously, if you repeat that thing many times with different people, more people will end up getting killed. If you say, I'll toss the coin and 50% of the times you kill three of them. So it's worse. So I think something like that may be going on in the sort of mental gymnastics of the person who tells themselves that they're not really doing anything wrong, because there's a good chance that what their purchase of the chicken made no difference, when that's true, but it might have made quite a big difference.
So maybe the contingencies are really important. So maybe the particular facts are really important. So it's really important what the thresholds are for your supermarket, and it's very important exactly how many extra chickens they order above that threshold. And it's very important what your probability is of affecting that. Because it seems like how you weight those and the particular numbers involved in that case are going to determine this outcome. I'd like, though, to think about it in a different way. So I'd like to think about a world where I exist and a world where I don't exist, or a world where I eat meat and a world where I don't. So let's use the latter conception. So I want to compare two worlds. The one is where Jason eats meat. I happen to eat meat, by the way. and the other world where Jason doesn't eat meat. What is the total difference in the number of animals slaughtered at the end of the day? So we have this God's eye view. If the number of animals slaughtered is different, if the difference is minimal at the end of my life in the one world and at the same point of time in the other world, that seems to be a compelling reason to think that it didn't really matter whether I ate those.
Well, that would be true from the God's eye point of view. You might have said, oh, well, here's this guy. He could have eaten meat and it would have made no difference or minimal difference. And let's say he would have enjoyed his meals more. And, you know, we're putting aside all of the other factors like the health issues and the climate change issues of animal production and so on. So in that case, then afterwards, from the God's eye point of view, you could have said, well, you know, he might as well have eaten meat. It would have, you know, maybe would have worked out to maximize happiness if he had. But if you can't know that in advance, and if the odds are that it would have come out differently, you know, I think we have to judge you. We have to say, are you doing the right thing or the wrong thing on the basis of expected utility? Now, I mean, let me give you another example. You're driving along a curvy two-lane highway behind a slow car, and you're tired of going really slowly behind this car. You want to pass it, but it's very curvy. And if you pass it, there is a chance. There's not a lot of traffic coming the other way, but there's some traffic. There's a chance that you will have a head-on collision and kill yourself and your family plus passengers in the other car, right? Now, you know, suppose you're too impatient and you do pass the car and luckily there's nothing coming. So then you could say, you know, looking at this later from the God's eye point of view, well, it's good that he passed the car because he got to his destination a bit earlier, he wasn't so frustrated, and nothing bad happened. But that doesn't mean that you're not blameworthy for having risked the lives of your family and the people in the other car just in order to get to your destination a few minutes earlier.
So would it make a difference if we change the amount of suffering that animals in factory farms endure? So one of the reasons why we have so many animals in the world is because of factory farming. So billions and billions of pigs and chickens are produced because of this desire for meat. Now, I imagine that it is the case that for a lot of those animals, it would have been better for them never to have been born. So, for example, male chicks are going to be tossed into meat grinders almost immediately because they don't have much economic value. And so it might be better for that chick never to have been born. But if we change the facts so that you get some positive net utility out of rearing the animals, that you reduce the cruel practices, that you reduce the cruelty and death, does that then become permissible to have that? Or could it even become obligatory and that we'd be generating more utility than ceasing all production of animals?
Well, if you raise the quality of their lives enough, and as I say, you bracket off the things like the contribution to climate change, the fact that it's you know, we haven't actually mentioned this, but factory farming wastes food supply. Some people say, oh, well, we need this to feed the growing population. But of course, if you confine animals indoors, you have to grow food and feed it to the animals, and you get back a small fraction of the food value of what you put in. So it's bad in terms of wasting food as well as those other factors. But if you bracket all of those things away and you just look at animals' lives, then you could say if the animals have positive lives, you know, they're being looked after, they're being respected, then that's certainly, you know, it's not wrong to support that kind of industry. And maybe on some ethical views, you would say it's the right thing to do. It's obligatory to do. You know, so I think that's conceivable, but I think it's a tiny proportion of the animals produced for food who would get through this barrier. I actually looked at the statistics a while ago for chickens in the United States, and the number of chickens who are not confined in this mass, you know, 20,000 birds in a shed kind of production is 0.2%. So in other words, 99.8% of chickens are broiler chickens. Or another way of putting it is 2 chickens in every 1,000 produced in the United States are not. There's not much of this kind of product around. If you can find it and you're happy enough about it and you really want to continue to eat meat, I'm not going to condemn you for finding those free-living chickens who have good lives and eating them. I think, to me, that's not the real issue. That's why I'm not saying that what you're doing is fine, but I am saying I'm not going to have a campaign against it in the way that I would have a campaign against factory farming and purchasing those products, because that's the dominant form of suffering that we're inflicting on animals across the entire world now.
So I wonder what you would think of this case. How do you feel about someone who only purchases meat just before or just after it's expired on the shelves? So the meat is about to expire on the supermarket shelf. They are obliged to throw it away, and just before they place it in the bin, you say, "I will buy that meat." It won't affect the orders that they put in the following day. Perhaps you won't buy the meat; you'll just take the meat. You take it out of the bin.
If you take it out of the bin, that's different, I think. I've actually been at dumpster diving with a group of the people. They call themselves freegans, right? So they weren't exactly vegans, because if it came out of the dumpster bin, they would eat meat. I think the argument that you're using.
Yeah, because your argument, if I understand it correctly, rests on the suffering of the animals involved and your causal link to that, but not the death of the animal. If you thought that the death of the animal is what mattered, then maybe there'd be some reason to think that you shouldn't even dumpster dive, because you'd be connected somehow with eating this corpse, and the fact that it became a corpse is wrong. But it does permit these sort of edge cases, your view.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would, even if I thought that the death was wrong, as long as I'm a consequentialist, I would think there has to be a causal connection. If there is no cause, if people are pulling it out of a dumpster bin, that's fine. I mean, if they're going along country roads, Australian country roads, there's a fair chance that you will find a dead kangaroo beside the road. It might depend a bit of how long it's been dead. If it's fresh enough for you and you want to go and eat it, you're not doing any harm. The kangaroo was dead anyway. So I think that's perfectly acceptable. I have no moral objection to that at all.
So the reason I wanted you to give that answer is, then I wanted to ask is, suppose we switch out the meat for human meat. So suppose it's dumpster diving for human corpses that have been thrown out by the mortician. Or it's roadkill, but it's of a human. So it's a person who died in a road accident. Would you hold the same view that there's nothing impermissible about digging into that human on the side of the road?
Well, one difference might be that the family of the human would be shocked and horrified to know that you had found the body and dined on it. They would think, no, we wanted to give our loved one a proper funeral and bury them and so on. So there is that difference, but of course you can tweak the example a little bit so that this is some lonely hermit you happen to know who nobody will care about. People might wonder, they will just think that, they've gone off, wandered off somewhere else, and that's why we don't see them anymore. It's getting a bit ghoulish now, I suppose, but if you really wanted to do that, and this is hypothetically, you could be absolutely guaranteed that nobody would find out about it and be shocked and horrified. I don't think it's hard for me to see what's wrong with it. Obviously, the person is dead. You're not harming them in any way. So the only harms you could be would be harms that for others. And if we just stipulate that there are no harms that occur to others, I can't really see what's wrong with it.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for an absolutely wonderful conversation. We've covered so much ground in such an eloquent way, and we'd love to have you back on the show anytime.
Thanks very much, Mark, and thanks, Jason. It's been enjoyable and stimulating. I've appreciated your questions and your pushing me to be precise about the positions that I hold. So thanks a lot for that.